This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Green Top Grocery opened to high expectations after 5 years of effort to get it up and running. 6 months later,
it's sort of like, but then there's a real place that then you can start to look at and say, okay, well, this could be better. Well, I'd hoped it was this.
Green Top's Melanie Shelato and General Manager Michael Pennington talk with Ryan Denham about what remains to be accomplished. Hear how Illinois State University might be able to fill a gap in cybersecurity jobs. And Mayor Terry Renner is live in the studio. He talks about a tax increase for the library, a tax increase that is off the table, and how all of it affects the next budget. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. Is December 12th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Taxes will increase slightly in the city of Bloomington. Aldermen voted to increase the property tax levy for the library. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio and will also talk about the budget process, a series of mayoral town hall meetings, and fire department response times. Mayor, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Great to be here, Mike.
While the library levy will increase, property taxes for the city of Bloomington itself will not increase. Taking this revenue option off the table, how will aldermen close the up to $3 million deficit facing the city in the next budget?
Well, that's a great question. That's the pun intended, silver dollar question. At this point, let's just also clarify about the library. I think we were talking about $3 a year, something like that. It's an extremely minimal amount of money that the library was asking for. But the city of Bloomington's 13% of the property tax bill is remaining flat. It has been steady or a slight decline in property taxes for about the last 7-8 years. The city council has almost unanimously, most years unanimously, stayed away from that. So if property taxes are off the table, taxes generally, I think there's very little appetite for any kind of raising of taxes. It could be that we are facing quite a few cuts in certain services. It may very well be also that we focus on some user fees and obviously more ways to grow the local economy. And that's one of the most important ways that you're able to provide the services that are necessary by growing the local economy.
Interim City Manager Steve Rasmussen announced meetings with aldermen prior to the holiday break to review the budget. Sounds like he'll be simplifying it for aldermen, 4 high-level slides. What will aldermen see, do you think, and will it give them some direction on what could be some tough decisions facing city programs and services?
I don't know that it's giving direction. I think it's just identifying as precisely as possible the problem. And as I understand it, we tentatively have a date, and that will be December 20th, the date actually of my last town hall meeting. And that will be at noon in City Hall, unless something has changed. Literally, as I just left City Manager Steve Rasmussen about 20 minutes ago, that seemed to be something that 6 aldermen could make and me. So that looks like that'll be the briefing. And then the other 2 aldermen will be briefed the next day. It's basically just a budget briefing about where we are this year and why over the next several years we've got some serious challenges. Some of it is that we adopted that bold police fire prevention police and fire pension policy that we got an award for. And we did have a dedicated revenue stream, but that dedicated revenue stream covered us for a few years. We had 5 to 6 really tough years, and we're in the middle of that. So we've got a few of those. The other thing is, of course, is that our our revenues are flat or declining, especially sales taxes. Since we've stayed away from property taxes as much as we possibly can, we have been focusing on sales taxes, gas taxes, to fund our streets, infrastructure, and those, unfortunately, are flat, and our costs are going up.
Steve Rasmussen is working on 13 different items based on council input from a recent retreat. Solid waste and golf courses are still on the table as areas that could face realignment. Steve Rasmussen was in the studio for Sound Ideas on November 20th. I was going to play you a sound cut, but apparently we have some technical difficulties. But basically he said that he thought there were three to five areas where he thought it could add up to $3 million in cuts, but the council would have to make that decision. Do you think the council has the history of making those kinds of tough decisions to actually cut that kind of money?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the council does not have the history of making those kinds of cuts. Will the council make these kinds of cuts? I'm confident that, well, whether it's all cuts or maybe some user fees, like maybe we up golf fees by a certain amount, maybe we do not have bulk waste, or maybe we only have bulk waste twice a year, whatever those realignment of services might be, we're going to have a balanced budget, and we're going to have it in time.
So bulk waste, let's just explore that for a moment. Let's say that there is just bulk waste twice a year, all right? That's a hypothetical.
Could be. That came before the council several years ago, and the council didn't want to, again, we've been fooling around with bulk waste and trash
for years.
More than that, more because it was a couple years before I was even mayor.
But if you're only doing bulk waste twice a year, you don't need the staff on the city payroll to actually handle all of that bulk waste. So the council will have to face off or see those people in council chambers when it's time to make that decision. Can they lay off people? Can they make that decision?
That's not the biggest issue, because we can reallocate people to Parks and Rec.
Are you saving any real money then? If you're not cutting people.
Well, yes, we are. If we reallocate them to Parks and Rec, for example, and I think that's where much of the change has been, but if we're reallocating people to Parks and Rec and we're not hiring as many seasonal people, then yes, absolutely, we do save money. And also we save money in terms of tipping fees and anything that we're bringing to landfills. And so, the rough guesstimate, I believe, is somewhere around $1.5 million that we could conceivably that it cost us. I don't know that we're going to save that much, because I don't think anybody's talking about cutting the service out completely, at least among the elected officials.
How does your line item veto work, and do you think you'll end up making decisions that the council can't reach as a group?
If we do not have a balanced budget, and the only time we've had this was back in the fall of 2014, which was the fiscal 2015 budget, I did have to several times use what ultimately was a veto threat in order to get the council back to the table to really decide that they had to pay their bills. We had to do something. You either had to cut services, or you had to increase fees, or you had to increase taxes. I mean, there really are only a few ways that you balance budgets. I'm very confident that this council is very well prepared. They've asked for this. They've been very proactive. I'm very confident that I'm not going to have to go down either a veto or a line item veto path. But a line item veto is much more surgical. It may very well be that once the budget is passed, that it turns out as I go through it, that there are an item or two that I decide to use a line item veto on.
Ward 2 Alderman David Sage commended Fire Department Chief Brian Moore for doing more with less last night, but response times are not where the fire chief thinks they should be, and staffing is not sustainable. They need people. People cost money. How do you reconcile budget cutting and holding the line on revenue when weighing it with those public safety needs?
Well, the public safety is our highest priority. When it comes to 911 service, if you're having a heart attack or your house is on fire or whatever the case might be, or if it's police, that's our highest priority. And the money that he's talking about in terms of these positions is in this year's budget. So we have the money to pay for the firefighters that we need. We do need perhaps an additional ambulance. We need additional resources in the fire department next year. And that's to, in order to reduce our response times for the northeastern part of the city. And ironically, it turns out that if we get an extra ambulance in Fire Station 1, which is downtown, the ripple effect of that is we can help reduce response times in the northeastern part of Bloomington. So literally, these are life and death situations. So anytime you have a budget, it's not all, you are prioritizing. It's not all cuts. There may be some things that you actually have to increase expenditures in because they are so essential.
And the library levy, why is this the right time for that revenue increase?
Well, for a variety of reasons. Ultimately, whether the library stays where it is and expands or even keeps its current facility and fixes it up or maybe moves, as the Downtown Task Force has recommended or at least suggested, to where the Market Street Garage is, they are going to need capital improvements. They have a building that was built in the mid-1970s, and while there were some improvements about 14 years ago, they're definitely in need of that. And the other thing is that even with this, very minor, I think the average household will pay $3 or $4 a year, not a month, a year. We are still considerably lower than either Peoria or Normal or Decatur or Champaign or Urbana or Springfield or any of our library boards around us.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You've had one town hall meeting. There were some awkward moments at the first one. You're doing two more. What do you want to accomplish at the next one?
Well, the next one is tonight, and it's at the BCPA from 5:30 to 7. And I hope that anyone who has ideas or thoughts or questions, or even if they're just interested in finding out what's going on, will come by. What I'm hoping that we can find out is more about what's on people's minds, and these are held at different locations, essentially grouped by wards, so that we can have one group of three wards, and that was the east side. Now we're kind of the central, and now we're going to do the west side of Bloomington, another group of three wards, and hopefully we can get some different ideas and perspectives about what the city's priorities should be. If there are some interesting ideas, especially for doing more with less, we're always open. And so that's what I hope we have. And I hope we have more civilized dialogue than we had at the first one, which was not as productive as I would have hoped.
Well, that's my question. Are the town hall meetings worth it as you give yet another forum to some frequent critics of yours and frequent critics of city government that you hear from every other week in the council chambers everywhere? Anyway.
Well, let me also be clear. I would just add, I don't think we're just talking about critics. Nobody likes criticism, but if you've got criticism and you've got some constructive ideas and you say, oh gosh, yes, sure. I think what we're talking about are people who are, they may be well-intentioned, but in most cases, not all, but in most cases, they are totally misinformed and they very rarely offer us positive solutions that we can actually use. And so that's what we're searching for. Tonight, consistent with our ordinance. And again, this is a mayor's open house, or not open house, but town hall meeting. I don't have to do these. I have an open house. I have a town hall meetings. I want to hear what people are saying. Even people who not just disagree with me, but may have ideas that are unrealistic. But tonight, we're going to start with the people who have not had their say. And that's also consistent with our ordinance. So especially if you didn't show up to the first, please come tonight. We would love to hear from you, whether or not
at the BCPA tonight. At what time?
At between 5:30 to 7.
And the third one on the west side is when?
5:30 to 7 on the 20th of December.
And the location for the third one?
And that is the Miller Park Pavilion. So we've done east. Now we're doing central. We're going to do West Bloomington. And so just again, democracy is a messy process. I think it's somewhat unfortunate that we seem to have a very few number of very loud voices that unfortunately are misinformed on a lot of issues that do detract from having a productive, robust public conversation. That's what I want, a robust public conversation.
There was a brief but a little vague update from City Attorney Jeff Juergens last night regarding agenda management. What's going on?
I have absolutely no idea.
Shouldn't you? As mayor,
well, this,
I mean, you know some of what's going on.
I know what's going on behind the scenes, and there are some things that I have some thoughts on that I would prefer not to share in public. But at this point, it seemed like it was a solution in search of a problem. I don't say that there is that there are no issues with staff being directed to do certain things, but I think this is the type of thing that we could have helped, you know, done informally if we sat down and just talked to each other.
Is the end result, are you concerned that the end result will still be removing your agenda as mayor, someone who was elected to represent the entire city across all wards, removing your power to control the agenda or put things on the agenda?
I would hope that that's not the case. I strongly oppose that, not just because I'm mayor. I think any mayor needs to have that authority. If I go to the table, for example, with the mayor of Carlock, with the mayor of Danvers, the mayor of Normal, the mayor of Downs, and we all come to a deal, it would really be bad if the mayor of Bloomington is the only person who can't guarantee that they're going to bring that deal back to their city council.
So Alderman Sage, you think, is searching, is, as you put it, looking for a solution for a problem that doesn't exist.
I think he's got a solution. I think there's some miscommunication on in terms of agenda setting.
So where is it headed, do you think?
I think we're going to continue to talk about it, and there may be some things that we do put into place that where we try as much as possible to reduce whatever staff time might be put into requests by aldermen or by the mayor as we move forward. The other thing is that I myself, we all can do better at communication. I can do better at communicating with aldermen, and aldermen can do better at communicating with me, and I think this is helping.
Okay. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal stop by Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Mike.
Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It took 5 years of community meetings, fundraising, and planning to open Bloomington's first grocery store co-op. Now, 7 months after opening day, those behind Green Top Grocery say their work is far from over. Facing increased competition and softer sales than one market study predicted, Green Top is making some bold changes to stay on track. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Green Top board member Melanie Shelito and general manager Michael Pennington about their first 7 months in business. Pennington says it's going well.
We are adjusting to the reality of running a grocery store. You know, we spent a good 5 years or so planning how to open a co-op, and now that we're open, we're adjusting and developing to better serve this community. Sales in some departments have been well. Departments that focus on local products like produce and meat and surprisingly beer and wine have been doing really well. A little softer in other areas, but we're making adjustments to that so that we can be sustainable and serve this community for a long time in the future.
You said beer and wine, and it surprised you that it was doing as well as it is?
Well, in relation to the rest of the store, beer and wine is outperforming what a store of our size in this type of community typically does. I don't know if that's because we have a particularly good selection or this community particularly likes beer and wine, but it has been doing pretty well for us, yes.
So you revamped the deli, I understand. So kind of what's involved with that and why did you do that?
We heard from our owners that we wanted to have some a little bit more diversity in what we offered and at hot options at the deli. And we were also looking at what was moving and what wasn't moving and made a decision to switch to a taco bar, which would allow us to offer a hot meal option to everybody, and has gone over really well. Sales in the taco bar have been really pretty steady and pretty good for us since we launched, and has had a great amount of excitement from owners and others on Facebook and from customer comments in the store.
Okay, so you're getting the sense that people understand they can just kind of walk in, pick up something for lunch, and move on with their day?
Exactly.
Okay. How does the store's performance up to this point, after 6 months, kind of compare to what you were expecting and what the board was kind of projecting?
Well, we did a market study a couple years back, and it had certain numbers in it, but you know, the market has changed since then. New competition's opened up. Existing competition has really upped their game in natural and organic foods. So the landscape is a little different. Sales are not quite what that market study said, but they're still strong and steady. and we're seeing growth as we go forward.
What are some things that you guys did to adjust to that changing landscape? I assume you're referring to Fresh Thyme opening kind of at the same time you guys did and some other factors.
Well, we just need to reemphasize the things that really set us apart. We are a value-oriented and a mission-driven organization that focuses on local foods and supporting local producers, doubling down on those values and what really make Green Top a unique business in this community.
So we're doing a six-month checkup here, Michael. I wanted to ask about staffing levels at the store. We've heard some rumors that maybe some folks had to get laid off recently. I wanted to ask about that, see if that was true, and if so, you know, how should folks read that as a sign of health at the store?
Well, grocery is a seasonal business, and sales go up and down. And like any business, labor hours go up and down as well in reaction to that. Part of rerunning a responsible business is making those necessary adjustments.
I'm an owner myself, so I want to know a little bit more about how you market to owners and folks who are not owners. What are some things you've done, and do you think you're doing enough at this point to reach the owner side and the non-owners?
I think that when we were organizing and we were talking to all the people in the community and we were talking to them about the reasons to become an owner and the reasons why the community needed a co-op, I think one of the best parts of that is that at that time, the co-op is in your head, it's in your mind, it's in your imagination, and it can be anything you want, right? Like everybody has a vision for what it's going to be. And as much as you try and answer all those questions and kind of ground those visions in reality, I think there's always going to be a little bit of a disconnect that then when the doors are on the store and they walk in and they're like, wow, this is gorgeous. It's better than I pictured. You know, we did hear that. But then it's sort of like, but then there's a real place that then you can start to look at and say, okay, well, this could be better. Well, I'd hoped it was this. Well, I thought it was going to be this. And so I think that one of the things that we've been working to do is kind of address those misalignments, I guess is the best word for what people envisioned. You know, I don't feel at all that we strayed from what we said we were going to do. In fact, I feel like we've accomplished beyond what we said we were going to do, you know, back in the day. But when we talked about we're going to bring local food, it's going to be a lot of organic and well labeled. Okay, well, people, I think in their head, they felt like, well, if it was local, it's going to be cheaper. It's going to be, and so, that's one of those misnomers, right? Like cheap food, but it's not really cheap food. It's that somewhere along the production line, someone's getting poorly paid, you know, ethical values. So that's the conversation. And so that's the kind of things that we're trying to talk about more is about those values, because if it's purely cost, then, well, chances are Walmart's going to win that every time, right? But Green Top isn't really just about cost. It's not just about food. It's the fact that this store is an economic driver for so many other things, for the farmers, for the other charitable organizations that people donate to in-store. And so the store is a catalyst for good things that flow throughout the community. And so, yeah, if we just talk about, you know, a box of cereal to a box of cereal, that was never supposed to be the conversation. But the reality is, once it's a grocery store and not an ideal, then you have to come down to the reality and say, okay, well, let's talk about dollars to dollars and talk about where your dollars go and what they do and how hard they work. And so that is, in my mind, the biggest marketing message we have to keep doing and having our owners talk about at coffee with a friend and at the office when somebody goes, oh, what is that place? You know, I've heard it was expensive. Ah, that's a great opportunity. Have that conversation about, well, what's really expensive? What's value? What are you getting every time you spend a dollar at Green Top? Look at where it goes. Look at where it stays, which is right here, versus that same dollar. Look where it goes when you spend it at a chain store. So that's those, and we have to give our owners the information to share that and start that story rolling again.
Food prices obviously don't represent all of what Green Top Grocery is or what you value, but it is important to shoppers. So how would you, Michael, characterize price and selection at Green Top Grocery as of today?
Well, we're a store that tries to be accessible to anybody. You don't have to be a certain demographic to be able to shop at Green Top. So we're making efforts to become able to accept book vouchers by bringing in products that are a little bit lower price point. We are already able to accept EBT and SNAP benefits. And just recently we did price drops on about 400 items throughout the store to just make the entire store more accessible to everybody.
Yeah, we heard from an owner who was who saw a sale recently and was wondering, oh, I didn't know they did sales, and they do sales now.
We put products on sale all the time. We have a bi-weekly sales cycle, and the products that are on sale are comparable to prices anywhere else in town. And oftentimes we are the best price in town.
But how do you change grocery shopping habits? I think all of us, once you find a grocery store you really like, you just feel comfortable going back there again and again. Even when they rearrange the stuff on the shelves, it can be annoying, like even within the same store. Can you talk, please, about how hard it is to change people's shopping habits and to make Greentop part of their weekly shopping and to kind of work that into their normal routine? Because I bet it's not easy.
It's not easy. People are creatures of routine, and once you fall into a routine, you tend to stick with it. But we offer something unique, and once people get a taste for that unique product, I think they'll make that extra trip or that special trip to get something at Greentop that you can't get anywhere else to be able to support the mission and the values of Greentop.
Well, and I think the other challenge is, like, when we go to, if you go to one chain versus another chain, they're all going to sell checks. They're all going to sell, the same brands that you're familiar with, whereas you come into Greentop, and there's a little bit of that. Some brands you recognize, but there's a lot of new brands, and it can be a little disconcerting. You're like, oh, well, I know I like Nestle versus this, or I like, and suddenly you're faced with a whole new product selection, and you have no, basis for saying, do I like this brand of kidney beans? I don't know. And, my family has, we shop there pretty much exclusively, and we just kind of said in the beginning, well, let's give it a go. Let's see what these strange and unusual brands, and I will say that almost to a number, we've tried these out and went, oh my gosh, that's really good. We're very brand loyal in a lot of ways, and so it's definitely a hurdle, get people to try something completely new.
We're doing lots of sampling in the store. Going there any day of the week, you'll see four or five
different samples
out there. And we're always really good if a customer has any questions about a product, we'll open that product up and let them try it. Because these are unfamiliar brands to a lot of people. But once you try it, you realize that it has a better quality or a better taste than what you might be used to, and I can make that purchase.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm joined in studio by Michael Pennington, the general manager at Greentop Grocery in Bloomington, and Melanie Shelido, one of the Greentop board members. For folks who may not know, can you briefly explain the concept of a grocery store co-op and what ownership actually means? We've referenced owners and non-owners a couple of times already. Just for folks who may not know what that is, can you explain?
A co-op is a business that is owned by the people who choose to buy shares in it. So in our case, for Greentop Grocery, for the last 5 years and on into the future, we sell ownerships. And so if someone wanted to back this project, to support this project as an owner, they would buy in, and ownership price is $200, and that's one time, and then there's no annual fees or anything like that. But you become an owner, and you have a vote at the annual meeting. You get extra information. There's owner newsletters that go out. There are owner appreciation weekends where there's extra benefits and perks. There's things like you can rent out the demo kitchen space, at a free, mm-hmm. free for to rent out the kitchen space for a certain number of hours. There's just a lot of perks within store, discounts if you make a bulk buy, which I've been taking a lot of advantage of. One of the biggest misconceptions when we talk about ownership is that people think that you have to be an owner to shop there. I think the Sam's comparison is what people have in their heads. But one of the things that we battle constantly is people think that, well, I'm not an owner. I don't care to become an owner, so I can't shop there. Absolutely not true. It is open to everyone to come and shop. Come check it out. If you, fall in love with it and want to become an owner, great, but absolutely not required. This is for the entire community. Please come have a look. It's not like you have to be an owner.
And Melanie, you've talked about values a lot during the conversation here. Customers are given a wooden token when they check out, and they can drop that into a jar supporting a community nonprofit. Who's been helped by that, and how much are these organizations getting?
So there's actually two different programs. There's something called Roundup at the Register, which is one of those things that when you check out and it's comes to whatever and 87 cents, the cashier will say, and would you like to round up? And they'll round up to the next whole dollar. Which, personally, as someone who is terrible at balancing their checkbook, this makes it really nice because it's all nice even zeros. But that extra number of cents then goes, and you see on the big display right there at the checkout, you're like, boop, and you watch the number change, and that is going to one of the charities for that month. And so it's pretty neat. You can see it was. Last month was the Labyrinth program through the YWCA. In this day and age, with all of the nonprofits and the charitable organizations, you know, they're struggling. And I felt really great. And every month when I see the display with the new organization that's a recipient, I feel really good about that, because I feel like $1,000 or thereabouts, it feels like it's right around $1,000 every time, you know, every month. That's going to go, you know, pay a couple people's salary or expand some services or keep the services going. That feels really, really good. And that's actually separate from the cute little wooden token that you mentioned, which are, if you bring your own bags, you get a little token. And so then you get to vote. There's three jars sitting there, and you get to vote for one of three other organizations who then... I think Green Top tallies up the tokens and sends them a check as well. So there's just multiple ways. If you choose not to round up, you still could get a little token. And so there's all these different organizations. And those organizations were voted on by the owners.
That's Melanie Sheldo, a board member at Green Top Grocery, joined in studio by Michael Pennington, the store's general manager. I'm Ryan Denham.
Green Top is now up to nearly 1,700 owners. The store features products from 66 farms and food producers in central Illinois. Pennington says those locally sourced products make up 27% of the store's sales, well above the industry average of about 2%. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. State Farm, Caterpillar, school districts, and hospitals, they're all in different businesses, but they need the same thing, cybersecurity professionals. And the bad news is that there's a shortage of workers with those skills. One 2017 study from Cybersecurity Ventures predicts there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity job positions by 2021. Illinois State University's School of Information Technology is hoping to fill that gap. It's recently launched a new cybersecurity major. The school's director, Mary Elaine Califf, and associate professor Glenn Sagers joined GLT's Ryan Denham in studio this morning to talk about those efforts. Califf and Sagers will update the local business community on cybersecurity education at this week's EDC by the Numbers event. Sagers says there's a huge need.
Hardly a day goes by that we don't hear about some sort of a data breach or intrusion into someone's system, hacking, whatever you'd like to call it. It's everywhere and not getting a whole lot better right now. I think there's a huge need for cybersecurity professionals.
What do you hear from some of Central Illinois' largest employers, the State Farms, Caterpillars, Countries, when it comes to their need to hire new cybersecurity folks?
It's really a matter of more please, as fast as you can get them to us. They have a great need for trained cybersecurity professionals. They have positions going unfilled at the moment for many of the companies. So they're just asking as quickly as we can get them out there educated properly.
Yeah, that was really much of the impetus behind us creating the actual major. We had a sequence in security for about a decade. But State Farm actually was talking to President Dietz and said, hey, we need security people. You need to give us more security people. And that then led to conversations, and my faculty were ready to jump on board and expand our program. And certainly all of our other industry partners jumped right in and said, hey, we need them too.
Yes, for folks who may not be aware, you did formally launch a cybersecurity major recently. Can you talk a little bit more about that? So when you talk about expansion, how much bigger is it going to be? And how does it look different than what the previous sequence looked like, the information security and assurance sequence?
So the previous sequence was part of our information systems major. And they took all of the things that an information systems major would take, including a significant business background, which is actually part of accreditation expectations for that major. So they had about three courses that were very specifically security. In expanding into the major, we added a couple more required courses. We've also added more in the way of electives that are security related, and reduced that business background just a little bit to make room for those technical courses. they still get much of the same IT background as our information systems students do.
How many students are we talking about in the major at this point, and where do you want to grow that to?
Well, the first question is a lot easier to answer. We're at 189 as of this fall. In terms of where we want to grow to, we can certainly go somewhat bigger, but it's an open question as to how much bigger. A lot of that is just faculty resources. Do we have enough faculty to teach all of the classes?
What are some ways that you keep that program, the cybersecurity program, kind of current with what the industry actually needs? I mean, what kind of relationships do you guys try to build with the Caterpillars, with State Farm and other companies to kind of stay current?
So as far as companies go, we have a meeting, an industry advisory board, we call it BIAC, and we meet twice a year with them to talk about what their needs, what they see coming up, what they see in our graduates, what they see missing in our graduates. So we're very in touch with our industry partners. As far as faculty staying up to date, it's really a matter of watching the news feeds and finding out what's the latest hack and how is it accomplished and what can I do to weave that into a story to tell my students so that they can understand how this happened and be able to prevent it when they get out in the real world.
How many other cybersecurity programs are there at Illinois Public Universities at this point?
There is one major that we're aware of at the undergraduate level at UI Springfield. I believe that there are some sequences in a few places. And, of course, U of I has a master's program.
And there are 9 schools in Illinois that are accredited as Center of Academic Excellence, or designated, rather, as Centers of Academic Excellence by the NSA and DHS. Those all have some sort of a security program, so we know of at least those.
Is it hard to find faculty to work in a program like yours that's growing in this way? I imagine other schools maybe around the nation are beefing up their own cybersecurity programs too. Plus, if you have that skill set, you could go work private sector, and you could, theoretically, I would guess, make a little bit more money.
It's certainly challenging. I was at a conference recently for the Center of Academic Excellence at Institutions, and they asked, how many of you are hiring? And over two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the room raised their hands that they're trying to find someone in security this year for a professor position. So there's lots and lots of demand. Supply probably not quite keeping up with that demand at this point.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm joined by Mary Elaine Califf, director of ISU's School of Information Technology, and Glenn Sagers, a faculty member in the school. Let's define cybersecurity. First of all, I think the word cyber always makes me think of like cyber cafes and some remnant from the 1990s. But what we're really talking about is information security. What is sort of the modern definition of that?
So I think really this is kind of a term that in some ways defies definition. The reason we chose cybersecurity for the name of the major was largely marketing. The federal government speaks of it as cybersecurity, or more commonly just cyber, which is a little meaningless, but we let it go. In any case, this program is really all about information assurance and security. How do you secure the information that's in all the databases? How do you secure information as it goes across the wire, traveling around the internet? So it's really about how do we keep the information secure. Cybersecurity is a subset of information assurance and security, but it's a fairly nebulous term in a lot of ways.
We've been talking a lot about supply and demand for these positions and supply and demand and faculty side, but let's actually talk brass tacks for a second. Could you talk about a project that a student or students might do in one of these cybersecurity courses that would directly prepare them for the type of project they might be assigned to as a entry-level employee at a large corporation doing information security?
On the defensive side, we have them set up devices such as firewalls, intrusion detection systems, intrusion prevention systems, and those are there to keep the bad guys out. On the other side of that, the offensive side, they will actually try to hack into various machines throughout the semester, and once they're in, see what can be stolen, see what they can get from that machine in order to get a better idea of what the bad guys are able to do. Those folks, when they go out in the real world, will be called penetration testers, and that is their goal, to get into the machines of that company before someone else can, to find those holes so that they can then be patched.
And in addition, we have some practical work in forensics where students are sort of doing cleanup, so they're taking something that maybe has been hacked, compromised, and trying to reconstruct what had been there, trying to figure out what happened just from the remains.
Are there any things that you can think of that policymakers or even the business community could do to better support cybersecurity education, not just at ISU, but you know, nationwide as a more systemic issue?
Well, I think that the first step that they could take is to just provide to support better computer education in K through 12. It's really problematic that students are coming out without an understanding of how computers work, given that we're all carrying a very powerful computer around in our pockets. So I think that's a good starting place, is to just support K through 12 instruction of computing. And by that, I don't mean how to use Word, but actual understanding of the machines.
And there are security programs for K through 6, middle school and on, that have been developed and really are mostly drop-in modules where a student can be exposed to cybersecurity at their level and understand why it's important to have good passwords. Even a six-year-old who's given a computer to sit in front of in kindergarten can understand what a password is. They can further understand that, hey, a longer password makes sense. And memorizing a passphrase, and by passphrase I mean something that is several words strung together, perhaps with a number in there, but not just random characters, which becomes very hard to remember. Even a six-year-old can remember that and start forming that habit very, very early.
You're speaking Thursday at the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council's BN by the Numbers event, a quarterly event that they do. What do you hope that attendees take away from your comments at that event?
I think the big thing that I'd like them to take away is the ongoing need for cybersecurity professionals. Most of them realize it already. I fully understand that. But just to get a feel for why they need additional help and additional personnel. More than that, I hope they take away a sense of what they can do to help support the schooling of some of these folks.
What are some of those things?
Well, again, that K through 12 idea that Dr. Califf just talked about. And there are obviously other direct ways that the businesses could help in the form of scholarships for students and so on. But really, I think even more important than that is that idea of getting into they're the ones that have kids in these schools, many of these business leaders. Get in there and talk to the teachers. We talk to the teachers, but we're just one person. If you get enough voices asking these teachers to include something, we might get some traction.
And I'd also like to see business become interested in supporting some of the programs that we do, in addition to supporting the university and our teaching, just looking at things like our high school cyber defense competition, our summer camp, which we're beginning to lean toward security. So these are opportunities for, say, high school students to come in and do some additional learning about security.
That's Mary Lane Califf, director of ISU's School of Information Technology, joined in studio today by Glenn Sagers, a faculty member in the school. I'm Ryan Denham.
Califf and Sagers are the featured speakers at Thursday's BN by the Numbers. This installment of the EDC series is focused on cybersecurity education, and GLT is a co-sponsor of the event. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Looking for a Christmas gift idea for the Beatles fan in your life? Jeff Wilson of North Street Records in Uptown Normal suggests the new Beatles Christmas box set to be released Friday. GLT's John Norton stopped by the store recently to get the story behind the release. It's an edition of GLT's What's on Your Turntable.
Yeah, well, it's that time of year again, so I get out some of my favorite Christmas records.
Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen.
You know, this is one of my all-time favorites, and they're actually going to finally reissue it. It's going to be available for the first time to the general public, whereas before it was only ever available to the fan club.
Is it a CD or is it an LP box?
No, it's a little box set of the original 7-inch records. You know, every year they would send a record to the fan club, and it was a little Christmas message flexi disc. They finally decided to reissue it, but the reissue is actually going to be on actual vinyl 45s, so it should be cool.
Hello, this is John speaking with his voice. We're all very happy to be able to talk to you like this on this little bit of plastic. This record reaches you at the end of a really gear year for us, and it's all due to you. When we made our first record on Parlophone towards the end of 1962...
Give us the background on why the Beatles even started doing these Christmas releases.
Well, you know, they had a fan club in 1963, and then all of a sudden they got worldwide famous and were totally overwhelmed with mail, people trying to join the fan club. Parents started calling in and complaining about not getting their information or any of their letters. So they came up with the idea to make Christmas messages and send those out to appease everybody. Everybody was getting so mad because they didn't get their stuff, so now all of a sudden they got a Christmas record, so I guess it was to shut them up.
Well, and it turned into a pretty smart marketing tool as well. I mean, this is something, a little kitschy thing that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, people really love them. These are very coveted items.
Christmas! Happy Christmas! Happy Christmas!
Can you give us a little bit of background on maybe how the recordings went?
Well, you know, they would be in the studio, you know, once they got a little bit famous, they could pretty much go into EMI anytime they wanted to. So after a session one day, they would decide to do Christmas records.
Jingle bell. Hello, everybody. This is Paul, and I'd just like to thank you all for buying our records during the past year. Oh, we hope you've enjoyed listening to the records as much as we've enjoyed melting them. No, that's wrong. Making them. We're in number 2 studio at the moment at EMI, taping this little message for you.
Tony Barrow, their press agent, is the guy that came up with it, and he would actually write out a scenario or maybe like some kind of a skit, and the Beatles would check it out and kind of loosely base the record on that. Of course, you know, when the Beatles get together and have a few drinks, it gets kind of crazy.
John speaking. Thanks all of you who bought me book. Thank you, folks, for buying it. It was very handy. It's been a busy year.
Did you write this yourself?
No. It's somebody's bad hand rotor. It's been a busy year, Beetle Peedles, one way and another, but it's been a great year, too. You fans have seen to that. Page 2.
It started in 1963.
Right.
And it ended in 1969. The album came out in 1970 because there was no 1970 Christmas flexi-disc release, so they put them all the previous ones on an album, right?
Yeah, one last final gift, you know, before they called the whole thing off, you know. They decided to put it all on one album. There was an English one and an American one. They both have different covers. The American album is a lot cooler looking.
Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.
Don't forget, Christmas is coming. Oh, that reminds me. Let's do a Christmas record.
Let's do a Christmas record.
Yeah, what should we say?
That's a good idea.
Was there a progression from 1963 through 1969 as to what the messages sounded like?
Yeah, you know, the early ones are all four of them sitting in a room, joking around, having a great time. They sound kind of like the Marx Brothers sometimes. They're really funny.
Well, I'm running over my time, and people are telling me to stop.
Stop shouting those animals.
So, I'll finish now with it. Wishing everyone happy Krimble and a Merry New Year, and especially all the ones who paid the subscription.
Ja, das wird und Dankeschön und den Christmas even. Ja, den Christmas even.
You know, by 1968, they all kind of recorded everything separately, and you could tell that the rot had set in.
I mean, you could hear that if you were paying attention?
Yeah, you know, it's like, I mean, they covered it up well, but, you know, if you know Beatles history and things like that, you know, you kind of know what they were going through at the time, and they tried to sound friendly, but you could tell there was a little bit of animosity going.
Wonder if we can compare, say, 1963 or 4 with 1968 or 9.
Oh, yeah, just play it, you know, and not to mention the later ones, they decided to do more music. Like, there's a song called Christmas Time is Here Again from the 67. Just really cool stuff, you know. It's like it changed with them, you know. They grew up and so did the records.
Interplan Zero Remix, page 444.
Christmas time is here again. Christmas time is here again.
We're talking with Jeff Wilson at North Street Records in Uptown Normal, giving you an idea of maybe a nice little holiday gift. The Christmas album box set is coming out from the Beatles on the 15th. Do you have some favorite parts from one of these years that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, you know, the 1968 release, they actually had Tiny Tim in on the session, and he sings Nowhere Man. That one always cracks me up.
Exactly, I did it then. He's a real nowhere man, living in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere
Is there anything deep, anything, any hidden meanings? There's anything that you could point out that on first or second listen you might not understand where it's coming from?
Oh, you know, like there's part of it where they'll be sitting there just talking and all of a sudden they'll play Helter Skelter at 78 RPM or something like that, you know?
What's the humor in that?
It just sounds goofy, I guess.
Oh. All right, didn't know if there was hidden messages in there. Paul is dead or something.
Yeah, I don't think so, man. I kind of wish there were, but no, I don't think there's any hidden messages because, you know, later on they basically did them just to get them done.
So why did it take so long to finally put this to a box set?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think anybody really knows. You know, it's one of those things where it's, you know, they haven't been made since 1970 and it's never been available to the general public, so maybe they just finally figured it's about time and it's the 50th anniversary and that kind of thing.
Sitting with me in the studio tonight is a cross-section of British youth. I'd like, first of all, to speak to you, Sir Gerald.
Oh, not a bit of it. We had a job to do, Michael.
Are the Flexi still out there from the individual years?
Oh, yeah, you can buy them. On average, they're a couple $100 a piece.
Okay.
The LPs are very rare, too, because, once again, they didn't make very many of them, and I've seen them go for upwards to $1,000 a piece for real ones.
We're talking the 1970 LP.
Original 1970 Apple record, yeah, and there's lots of counterfeits and pirates and things like that, so buyer beware.
Jeff Wilson at North Street Records in Uptown Normal, thanks for the Christmas gift idea. This is a cool one.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it, and Merry Christmas, everybody.
GLT's John Norton talking with Jeff Wilson of North Street Records about the Beatles' Christmas box set, which goes on sale Friday. Here's some of the experimental studio antics from the 1968 Beatles' Christmas album on Sound Ideas.
Hello, this is a big hi and a sincere Merry Christmas from yours truly, Ringo Starr.
Happy New Year, Happy Christmas, Happy Easter, Happy Autumn, Happy Michaelmas, everybody, Happy Christmas.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from John Norton and Ryan Denham. Thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for stopping by Sound Ideas. Let us know what you think of this show. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.